and please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Mike from the Longhorn Sunrisers.
I'm Michael and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is the Langhorne Sunrisers. We meet Monday through Saturday at 6 a.m. in Langhorne, PA. If you're ever awake and want to just drive really far, it's well worth it. We read a different piece of literature Monday through Friday and a speaker on Saturday. And I had the fortune this morning of chairing that meeting. I didn't really schedule my time too well. I was sitting there at 5:15 setting up chairs, and I'm like, oh my God, I got to speak tonight too. But you know, it didn't impact me. You know, I'm still here. So I have a sobriety date. It is October 31st, 2008. I had the fortune a couple of weeks ago. We had the fortune of celebrating 11 years. And I like speaking around this time because like October and is recovery month for me, where I relive in the first 10 days usually of November. I like relive every day of leading up to that. And it's some scary memories to some degree. I was 48 when I came to AA and still wonder why I stayed. I had a friend of my sister's, a really good friend. She's a nurse. She was in the program. And she was the one who encouraged me to go to that next meeting. And we were at the shore this summer. I hadn't seen her in, gosh, 6 or 7 years. And we're in Wawa and we're talking. And she says, I just got to tell you this. I said, what's that? And she said, I never thought you would stay. And defiant me was like, what do you mean I would never stay? And I'm ready to argue with her. And she said, you know, I'm glad you did. And I'm really glad I did. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia, so in Northeast Philadelphia, you typically would start drinking between the age of 12 and 13. It was like a rite of passage. I think everybody in Northeast Philadelphia drank between 12 and 13. I've not met anybody at an AA meeting who says they're from Northeast Philadelphia that did not drink between 12 and 13. Upon the 12 steps, I can say I have a wonderful family. I was one of five children. I was the middle child, and I lived like an only child. It was all about me. To this day, family will say, oh, you remember that, don't you? No. You were there. It didn't pertain to me, did it? And two wonderful parents had everything. I mean, I had everything that I thought I wanted, but it was never enough. When I went to outpatient, the first night the counselor said to me, tell me something when you were selfish in life. Go back if you can. Or, you know, go back. I'm like, oh, I got it. She said, what's that? And I said, I was 8 years old. It was the first year that I was allowed to say I didn't believe, oh, I don't want to ruin this for anybody here, that there's no Santa Claus. And yeah, I'm sorry. I do that. I'm sorry. It's just all about me. And I had a younger sister, younger brother, and two older sisters. So I woke up at about 3:30 in the morning. And my parents, my dad was a Philadelphia school teacher, and they were usually on strike. Or with five kids, it was, you know, they made a dollar, and not answering the phone to pay bills go a long way. So we didn't have much. But I would take the Sears catalog when it was delivered. Everybody who remembers the Sears catalog, I would follow the mailman down the street with this thing. It was typically like 800 pages thick, and I could tell you everything. People would say to me, what's on page 764? I'm like, that is a different kind of guitar this year. And I had multiple lists. So I wake up that morning and I go downstairs, and my mom would just arrange everything so nicely. And the mistake she made, she did not wrap gifts. So I could see everything. And I just rearranged all of the gifts. I got the best albums, the best games, and I went back to bed, and then when they woke everybody up, I did, oh, is it Christmas already? I'm 8 years old, and I come downstairs, and this did not matter to me until I really got into AA. my older sisters were like, oh, Mom, thank you. And I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking, you got the crappiest stuff. And I'm just sitting there like that. And my mom is sitting there like Lauren, just staring at me like, oh, you think you're smart? And I'm just looking, and my younger sister's like, oh, you got all the good stuff. I'm like, because I really deserved it, I think. So we go to breakfast, we eat breakfast, and I come back out, and my mom's rearranged every gift, and she stares right back at me. And that became that was my life. If I didn't have it, I took it, or I'd manipulate you into getting it, or I would just throw a tantrum. So school came easy to me. I never worked hard at all. And when I learned how to, dare I say, cheat, it became even easier. And never pushed, never really exerted myself, never worked hard, just wanted everything. And also decided to play the guitar at 8 years old. And I was devastated because you had to take lessons. Like, I took the guitar out of the box, and I watched the guy on TV, Glenn Campbell, play it, and he said he never took lessons. I'm like, oh, I could do this? And they're like, no, you have to take lessons. That guitar never got used. It was just one thing after the other. But fortunately, made it through college, very good jobs. The first drink at 12 and a half was in a garage playing street hockey, and the family wasn't home, and their dad had cans, 8 ounce cans of Rolling Rock. And we were sitting there, and one guy was 10, and the other one was actually 13. So we each grabbed a beer, and I just remember opening it. I took a sip of it. It was terrible. Terrible. And I turned to the older guy next to me. I said, this sucks. And he says to me, don't worry, just keep practicing, it gets better. That was like the only advice I ever took in my life, because I just kept practicing and practicing in there. And I was an introvert trapped in the body of an extrovert. And then alcohol came along, and it just took down a lot of barriers. I was able to go to parties and do stupid things, become more miserable at home. Basically, like, I was lazy. I was lazy. And, you know, fortunately, I got through school, got a good job, and then my drinking actually helped my career, I used to believe, because people liked having me around. I was fun to go out with, and I would always do something stupid. So I was able to advance because of that. And just never was comfortable in relationships. Never. Never. It was always, this is not going to work. If it's not going to work, I'm going to sabotage it. And it's much simpler, you know, living inside myself in there. So, got married, met a wonderful woman, got married, wonderful daughter, never enough. Really good jobs. But just never was comfortable. If I got a really good job or promotion, I was dissatisfied by like the third month, and I'm looking ahead. I could never be right where my feet were at. And if something went wrong, oh God, this is terrible. And, you know, I'm an analytical, I'm an accountant, so I grab everything in my mind. And as it got harder, the alcohol increased. It went from, just say, you know, weekends, and maybe after work, okay, maybe four nights a week, and weekends, to like coming home, and the first thing I did was that refrigerator was open, and then liquor. I never did a drug in my life, because I was too cheap, first of all, and lazy. I would just go get alcohol. Alcohol was so easy in there. And I more than made up for not doing drugs with alcohol, I'll tell you that. And as I got older, I was not as well received by the companies I worked for, because somebody told me, you cannot get along with the kids in the sandbox, can you? And I'd say, no, I can get by with just my brain and, you know, sheer will. Well, companies started asking me to leave. And my wife would say to me, do you think you drink too much? And of course, I would actually have one drink in my hand and another one there. And I'd be like, no, what do you mean? What do you mean? I don't think there's a picture of us, seriously, everybody without a drink in my hand. It was that way. Everybody I hung around with drank. I would try to manipulate my daughter's friends to the parents who drank, because I would just go drink all of their liquor, and I was funny, so they'd invite me back. I think some realized later, like, this guy does not leave. And then I did not like those families that didn't drink. Worst weekends where we're going to so-and-so's house. I'd be like, oh my God, those people don't drink. What am I going to do? And we went and visited my sister-in-law before I got sober, and they didn't want any liquor in the house, which I thought was just, I thought it was criminal. And I would just leave my beer out in the car, and I was always going to Dunkin' Donuts. And finally, I swear, my wife realized one day, there's no Dunkin' Donuts around here. And I would just go sit in the parking lot and listen to the radio and drink. And that's what I did. So, let's see, 42, 43. And one company, Comcast, asked me to leave. And then the next company did not ask me to leave. They told me to leave. And I did what anybody who had no self-control or discipline and loved to drink would do. Started my own business in my house. I had no idea what I was doing. I winged it and got lucky. That was my pattern in school. I would just kill my grades. I'd do great for the first half of the year, and then I'd just screw off. And I'd struggle home, you know, with whatever I got. And things were going good. I'm working at home. I'm important. And then the bottom dropped out. I had no plan, no discipline. So I'm living in Florida. We were in Florida for a long time, Northwest Florida, the Panhandle. And I go and I arrange an Eagles weekend trip with all my friends to go to New Orleans. Never forget, it was 2005. We're standing at the bar, and somebody gave me a gin and tonic. And I turned to one of my friends, and I said, I should be drinking this at home. And he works at home, and he's like, well, do you think that's a good idea? I'm like, yeah. You know, what am I going to do during the day? Because at this point, I was not willing. I was overwhelmed, but I couldn't tell anybody that I was overwhelmed with the career decision that I made. So what I started doing was a fake job. I would work from home, and I wouldn't do anything all day. And we had saved enough money that I could move this around and I could do that. And I'll tell you, a fake job is so much harder than a real job. It's not all it's cracked up to be. I would have legal pads where I would write out what I was going to tell people that day who asked me, how are things going? Oh, things are great. I got this going on. I got this. I got that. And I think my wife sort of suspected, so I had to work harder at not working. And with the gin, I remember driving home that week. It was a Monday. I drove home, and I stopped, and I bought a big bottle of gin and moved upstairs with me in the office. And but I made this solemn vow. My daughter was 10 or 11 at the time. I did not want to see her coming home and finding me drunk. She might find out that I have a drinking problem, let alone on the weekends, different story. Or passing out at night, different story. So my wife's working harder because the money's not coming in. And you can't take a lot of the 401k at once. Just advice, don't do it. She would get home from school at like 3. So I wasn't going to drink until 4. And I was like Fred Flintstone. When he would come out in the beginning of the Flintstones, he'd slide down that dinosaur. I'm on the second floor, and I could slide down the railing. It was 4 p.m., and I'm done for the day. Thank God I don't have to go back to that fake job the rest of the day. And just drunk. Then a neighbor would call on Friday and say, hey, we're playing poker. What time? Well, we're going to play about noon, because they were successful working from home or they had real jobs. And that 4 p.m. thing was relaxed on Fridays because My daughter would, I would just leave a note, playing poker somewhere. I never played poker until I started drinking a lot. And I found poker to be the best game for an alcoholic because you can sit there and just drink for hours and hours and lose money that you don't have. It was perfect in there. So you can feel the downward descent and the lying and the lying and the lying and living immorally and all the stuff that I used to just just have no respect for people who did that. How could anybody live that way? And knowing that I was had become the person that I used to make fun of all those years. So the don't drink, you shouldn't drink. Yeah. I never stopped. The only time I ever stopped, and it was for 2 days. New England's playing the Giants in the Super Bowl in 2008. And I decide I'm not going to record the game because I thought it was Mardi Gras time down there. So you had the Super Bowl and your Mardi Gras parade on the same day. So it was not a good day in our household because we had to come home before going to the neighbors who were having a Mardi Gras party who didn't drink. It was not a good ride home. And I pass out on the couch and I wake up. And Eli Manning's holding the Super Bowl trophy. And I'm looking like this, and I'm trying to rewind it because I want to see it, and I didn't record it. I was devastated the next day. I was really disturbed. I'm like, wow, I think I might have drank too much yesterday. I missed the Super Bowl. I was upset. So that was Tuesday. I was devastated. Wednesday, I was kind of like, it was just a game. You didn't hit the right button. Thursday, right back to it. And October 30th, 2008, I woke up on the couch at about 8:30, 9 o'clock. All the lights are off once again. My wife didn't drink. My daughter didn't drink. The dog liked to have a beer every now and then with me, but she was not drunk at this point. And I look out in our kitchen, and on the counter is a full drink. I go, oh, God, I got to get up. So I get off the couch. And we lived on a golf course and had a lake behind us. I'm looking out the window, and I had that drink there. And it was like looking at black and white TV. It was all gray. It was like fuzzy to me. And I'm looking out the window, and I said, God, I just can't keep doing this anymore. And I poured this drink out. Washed the glass out. I always poured the drink out because I didn't want them knowing that I was drinking at night. But I pour it out and I go to bed. And the next day, the state of Florida shows up at my door to bring to my attention the way I had been living. And I've never had it. I never had a speeding ticket. Never had anything. I'm arrested. Family's devastated. I remember sitting in the cell. And they have a little plexiglass cutout through the window. And the Phillies parade is on TV. And I'm in Northwest Florida sitting in the county jail. I'm thinking, I wish I was there. That's what I wished. And then I wished that I didn't want to go back, that they would not let me out of here because I couldn't face anybody. And then I thought, oh, why did you say yesterday, God, I can't keep doing this anymore? That was a stupid prayer. Because, we have our oh crap prayers, our God, get me out of here, And I remember thinking, that's why you shouldn't pray. So I get released. I remember when the detective said to me, your wife and sister have posted bail. And my voice, I was like Peter Brady in the Brady Bunch when his voice cracked. I'm like, I have to leave? Yeah, you have to leave. And so the bail bondsman drives me home. And he was so upbeat about everything. He comes into the house, and it was a lot of bail money. And he's willing to work with us. And I just want him to leave. I want him out of the house because the liquor cabinet is right there. I said, yeah, whatever. I'll do whatever. And he leaves. And I'm from up here, down there in Florida. Everybody knows at this point, or some know. My brother calls me. It's like, do you think you have a drinking problem? I'm like, what is it with you and this drinking problem thing? I'm fine. He asked me like five times. And I just said, you know what? I think I do have a drinking problem. I'll take care of it. I hung up the phone and my wife says to me, did you do it? And I say, I have a drinking problem. She said, no, you're a liar. She said, I don't believe anything you tell me. I said, I'm going to take care of this drinking thing. And she said, let your actions speak for you. And I don't know why. I think it was another, oh, because before she, when she said to me, why did you do what you did? I prayed again. And I said, God, please don't make me answer this question. So she walks away. And I'm like, oh my God, I think I got to like deal with this. So I go to, start looking for, treatment, because I don't know about alcohol. I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous in the fact that when I was working for Comcast and I was the general manager for this large operation, we hired this human resources director, and it was a tough environment, really tough market. And this gentleman said to me one day, right after we hired him, he said to me, Michael, I have to tell you something. I said, what's that, Tommy? And he said, if I have to run out of here quickly, or I have to get a phone call and leave, I only do it because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked at him and I said, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And he said, no, it's changed my life. And I said, better you than me. So after a while, this gentleman, it would be like a bad labor situation. And he would pull out this blue book and he'd say to us, do you mind if I read something to you first? And I said, this isn't any of this religious crap, is it? Because we're in the deep south and I'm sick of hearing that. It's like, no. And he would read it. And I started listening. And this was 2000. This was 8 years before I got sober. And he would, after a while, I would ask him, what does that book say about this? And he would turn to a page. And he always had a quote. I thought, like, it was genius. So he said to me one day, would you like this book? I'm like, no, that would just be so wrong. And I start going to treatment centers. By the way, I had no health insurance. So it would be really hard to afford treatment without health insurance. I have no idea what it is. I'm like, how much does it cost to go here? $12,000. Do you have anything like free? So finally, this gentleman, I walked into this one place, and this gentleman who worked for this treatment center, they got them all over the southeast, he just happened to be there. He was a visitor, and nobody was around. He said, here, I'll take you. Name was John, and John started interviewing me. And he said, listen, I just got to tell you this real quickly. You're a freaking alcoholic. You're an alcoholic, and you're going to die. I'm like, oh, the other ones are much nicer about that. And he said, you know, whatever you do, I hope you find your way to AA. He said, here's my card. I said, do you know any places that like can do some creative financing on treatment? And he gave me this place. He said, it's a spiritual based place and this is what you need. So my dad, I had not talked to my dad yet. Rested on Friday. This is Monday. And I walk outside of the treatment center. And it's sunny out. My wife and daughter are there. My daughter's off taking off from school to help me through all of this. My wife says to me, it's your dad. My knees buckle. I'm 48 years old. I said, hey, typical thing. How are you? He's like, no, more importantly, how are you? I said, I'm not sure. And he said, here's the deal. You take care of yourself, and I'll take care of your family. He said, you better deal with that drinking problem, Michael. So I am fully backed into a corner. And I go to this treatment place, and they have those pamphlets, and I pick up the one, do you think you're an alcoholic? 20 questions, right? 19 of them I answered yes to. The only one I did not answer yes to was, is there a history of alcoholism in your family? So I'm telling my sister, I said, there's no alcoholism in our family. She said, besides you, she said, let's go through it. And she starts naming off cousins and uncles. And I said, wait a minute. They're the people I hang out with at family functions. She's like, do you think? Do you really think? So I agree to do this outpatient thing. And I go to have the interview with the counselor. I tell her, like, I'm very complex. I think that's actually what I said. And I don't like to share. And she says, well, tell me about yourself. So about 10 minutes in, she says, okay, let me stop you there. She says, I don't know if they teach this in treatment school. I wondered after that. But she said to me, you've lived your life based on intelligence, willpower, and luck. And I lean forward and I nod my head proudly. I'm like, yes, I do. And she said, this is where it's gotten you. She said, that's all about you. And I'm broken down at this point, so I'm not going to give the answer I wanted to give, which is, that's right, it is about me. She said, you need to live your life based on information, planning, action, and review. I'm like, give a piece of paper, I got to write that down. She said, I think you have bigger problems right now than remembering this, but that's what you have to do. She said, what I'm telling you is that all these problems that you just shared with me are not your fault. I'm leaning more forward now. I said, really, whose fault is it? Because I need to talk to that person. She said, it's your brain's fault. It's your brain. She said, your brain. She said, you're a computer person, right? She said, you have sabotaged that brain. And alcohol, she said, you can't rewire a computer, right? Once it's like, yeah. She said, but it's okay. She said, it's not your fault. And there's a cure. I am leaning all the way forward now. And I said, what is it? She said, you have to go to AA the rest of your life. And so leaning forward, I go, the rest of my life. I said, I thought this was like an 8-week intensive outpatient thing. And she said, yes, it is. We get you stabilized if you want to, but AA keeps you sober for the rest of your life. So I go home that night. And I have absolutely no credibility. My wife says to me, how was it? I said, I got good news and I got bad news. She said, what's the good news? Not my fault. It's the brain. The brain's the problem. She said, okay, and what's the bad news? I got to go to freaking AA the rest of my life. So I go to the outpatient and the next day, they gave me 3 books. Book on the brain. Loved the book on the brain because that was the problem, right? Gave me a that book that this Tommy used to have at Comcast. I was not reading that. That was way too thick. And they gave me the 12 and 12. So if you can imagine the atmosphere in the house on a Saturday, the first full Saturday after all the crap settles, and I know I'm going to prison. I know I'm going. My lawyer told me, you're going to prison. Accept it. So my family leaves, they go out, and I pick up this 12 and 12 book. And I'm going to see how far I can get with this thing. And I open it up to the first page. Whoever cares to admit complete defeat. I was done. I sat there and I read that. As I'm reading it, I grew up Catholic. And there was this priest growing up, Father Brannick. He was the coolest priest ever. Good looking guy. He kind of like, we used to say like when they drew Jesus Christ on the holy cards, they used his image. He could play basketball. He could sing. He could tell jokes. And by the way, he ended up getting married and leaving the priesthood, but that's beside the point. Always have to say that. He would always talk about this prayer of St. Francis. Talked about it all the time. It's the only thing that I really remembered from 8 years of Catholic grade school, 4 years of Catholic high school, and 4 years of Catholic college was the prayer of St. Francis. And I'm reading this 12 and 12 book, and I'm saying to myself, this is like Father Brannick stuff. And my brother keeps calling me, this is a Saturday, and he wants me to go to a meeting. And I tell him, I went to outpatient twice this week. I went to this meeting on Friday, I did not like it, and I'm exhausted. Like, okay. So I keep reading this book, and it's almost 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and I open it to chapter 11. I don't want to give it away. I've already ruined Santa Claus for some people. But chapter 11, prayer and meditation, there it is. The prayer of St. Francis in this book. I drop the book. I'm like, oh my God. And they gave me a meeting list. And I look, and I knew enough about meeting lists The speaker meetings were good because I wouldn't have to participate. I could sit in the back. And I was told by my wife not to go to meetings in the little town we lived in. Well, this was in the little town we lived in. And I'm going. So I go to this meeting, speaker meeting. I like to say now there were probably 1,000 people there. There was probably about 75 people in a room, maybe half the size, and I find my way there. This guy gets up to speak. He's younger than me. He's got red hair. I think he's a little shorter than me because I'm still 6'5" in my mind. And he starts telling this story. And I was a very high achiever because I brought my big book with me to the meeting. And I had written in there, get a sponsor, because that was on the list from outpatient. And he starts telling the story. I go, oh my God, that's my freaking story. That's my sponsor. So the meeting ends. I swear I cannot tell you the last 45 minutes of his story because I just zoned out. And the meeting ends and everybody swarms him like he's a rock star. And I just start pushing through him like, excuse me. Hey, I'm Michael and you're going to be my sponsor. And he says to me, why don't you go to the back of the line and wait? And so I go to the back of the line and I make it up there. And he's like, okay, Michael, tell me about yourself. So I kind of tell him. And he was not real keen about sponsoring me. And he said, be at the 7 a.m. meeting on Monday morning and we're going to start on this. I show up on Monday morning, 7 a.m. meeting. He's not there. But this one guy pulled me aside, and I brought my big book there too. And he said to me, you know, most newcomers don't come back. Very rarely come back, so we probably won't see you again. He touched a defiant nerve in me. And he said, but I'm going to tell you the use of that book. Open it up to page 87. We're standing out on Highway 87, or Highway 98 in Gulf Breeze, Florida. And he makes me act out, pause when agitated or doubtful. He makes me take a deep breath and hold it, pause, let it out. And I'm thinking people are driving down this highway and they're going to see important me, who, by the way, made it in the newspapers. So if you didn't know me then, you knew me after that. And I did not want to be there. He said, so we won't see you tomorrow probably. It was really nice meeting you. And keep that book. Go to page 87. It'll save your life. Sure enough, guy was right. Saved my life. I went back the next day. Guy didn't show up again. I went back Wednesday. He didn't show up again. And they're asking me to read. They keep telling me, oh, we really appreciated what you shared today. I met this one guy who's like the big business guy down there. I was always trying to get a meeting with him. He walks into the meeting. He's got 25 years sober. And after the meeting's over, he comes up, he introduces himself. And he said, I really am glad you're here. So my ego is like this. And the next day was a Thursday. And it was a library, so you had two doors. And I'm waiting for this guy to come in. And he's not there. And I make the decision. If he ain't here, I'm leaving. I'm going out that door. I start to walk towards that door. This other gentleman walks in. Pat. I had met Pat 2 years before that. He came to my house when I was looking for health insurance. And he sat on the couch and talked to me for like an hour, which was weird because I didn't talk to anybody. I just wanted you out of my house. Leave the paperwork. We'll be good. And he just talked to me about life. And his niece went to school with my daughter. And I'm walking out and he looks at me and he says, Michael, I didn't know you were an alcoholic. And I just started laughing. And I said, Pat, neither did I. And we started laughing. He said, where are you going? I said, you know, I've been here 3 days waiting for this guy to sponsor me. He's not here. I'm going. He's like, who are you waiting for? I said, Thomas. He said, he's right behind me. And trust me when I tell you this, he's worth the wait, okay? Turns out Pat was Thomas's sponsor. I didn't know any of this. So Thomas meets with me and he says, he looks in the big book. I had already checked off the first three steps. And he takes a pen and he writes over it. He's a very easygoing guy. I must have pushed his buttons. And he says, we start from the beginning. And if we agree to meet at 10 a.m., because you don't have a job, right? I said, no. He said, and you're not here by 10 a.m., go find another sponsor. So if we were meeting at 10, I waited. I got there. I would sometimes stay after the 7 a.m. meeting just because I didn't want to go home. And he said, and when we agree to read something, you better have read it before we get here. And he didn't say it like that, but that's the way it came out. I took it seriously because I knew I couldn't. Like he said to me, you're like me. We floated through life and we knew all the answers. It doesn't work here. That set-aside prayer, I have not heard that in a while, and I really needed to hear that back then. And so we just started down this path. And I noticed my family was happier. They were encouraging me to go. It was just weird. One day, my wife says to me, "Why do you get up in the morning? You know what's going to happen, right?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "But I'll tell you." I said, "For 48 years, I hid from everything. I hid from anything difficult. I'm going to give this a try. I know it's, you know." And I said, "You have the bigger burden than I do. I mean, you got to carry a family." And one day my sponsor gave me a copy of My Name is Bill W. And I'd been sober about 60 days at that point. And he said to me, "You know, if you ever want to really get like a good idea about this program, this is a good movie to watch." So it was a Sunday night, and I'm going to sneak into the room and watch it. My wife and daughter say, "Can we watch this with you?" I'm uncomfortable. I say, "Yeah, okay." So they're watching it. And I remember when it came on, when it came on TV, I thought that was like the stupidest movie in the world. Drunk guy. And there's a scene in the movie that, because I wasn't sure how committed I was to this program, but I didn't really think I was, and I didn't know if I was. And there's a scene in the movie, and I always carry it with me, where Lois says to Bill, "Why do you do it to yourself?" And Bill says, "I've been standing here all afternoon asking myself the same question. I look out the window and I watch all the normal people walking by. It's funny, I don't think I ever felt really normal all my life. I mean, like other people. I feel different somehow, like I don't quite measure up. Ever since I can remember, I've had this feeling deep down in my gut, scared." And he goes on and on. I could read the whole thing, but I would cry and it would ruin it. Because I was sitting on this couch, not knowing, and tears are just coming down my face. Bawling like an infant. And my daughter pauses it and they look up and I point to the TV set. And I said, "That's me. That's me." And they just nodded. I could never say what he said. That's me. And the next day, I'm in. I am into this program. Said to Thomas, like, "It's time to do this." So we started on step two. And he had asked me in step one to write out all the ways I was powerless and unmanageable with alcohol. Quite a good list. Then we get to step two, and I said, wait a minute. Restore us to sanity? That means I'm insane. I'm not insane. And he said, he picks up my list and he says, "Michael, would an insane person," and he keeps reading down my list, and every one starts with, "Would an insane person do this? Would an insane person do that?" About six of them down, I'm like, okay, I'm insane. And I knew I was going to prison for 3 years. And he said to me about 2 months before I was headed in, "I think you should do that fourth step." And one day at a meeting, this young kid, 19 years old, Kruger, he worked on a boat, shared about doing his fifth step and just how freeing it was. I am pissed. I'm like, I'm going home and I'm doing that fourth step. And we walked through it all. And when I was sentenced, I was like 8 hours away. Some of my family was there, and my sponsor's there. My sponsor drove 8 hours. My daughter's best friend's family. These people, who I didn't want to go to their house because they didn't drink, they were there. You want to talk about guilt? So it's the night before, and I know I'm going in. And I see my sponsor talking to my wife and my daughter. Now, he had met my daughter. He had never met my wife, but she told me, "This is your problem. This isn't mine." And I see them nodding their heads. And I want to hear what this conversation's about because I got to know everything. So after it breaks up, he's got this big book open. I'm like, oh, Christ, what did he say? And he said to me, you know, I shared with them. They were talking about the Bill Wilson movie and that really made an impact on you and them. And he said, and I read one phrase to them. The alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. He said, and what I told him was, it's not his fault, but he has to deal with it. And, like, I got through 3 years in Florida State Prison. They had an active AA group in there. These sponsors came in every month, Tuesday, with literature. I became the chairperson. I was going to change the format because they wanted me to. Guy in there, James McKnight, throws down the 12 and 12 book on me. And he says, Mr. Smith, you might know a little bit about this program, but you better read those traditions. I'm like, what are they? Oh, those things in the back I never read. I said, how did you know about this? Like, you said you've been in here 26 years and you got sober in here. He said, yeah, because I read. I read our literature. You should read our literature. What else do I have to do? I read the literature. And that was the first place where somebody asked me to sponsor them. I'm running on the track, and this gentleman stops me, David, and he says, hey, I'd like to know would you sponsor me? And I say to him, why? And I'm going through my mind trying to come up with how busy I am, because I don't want to sponsor this person, because I don't know what I'm talking about. And we start working together, and I get released. And my sponsor's the one, because my family moved back to here. My sponsor and AA were the ones who helped me get back on my feet. But every one of them said to me, you do the work and we'll help you. And I fought hard to get back to Pennsylvania. State of Florida wanted me to stay a little bit longer. And I did the work. And I remember my PO, I was not mandated to go to AA. And he was an asshole. I usually don't say that. But he would say to me all the time, Mr. Smith, are you still going to those meetings? I said, yes, sir, I am. He's like, good. Best thing. So I'm leaving prison, and I go to the chaplain. We had the meeting in the chapel. I wanted to thank the chaplain for hosting these meetings, because that's not not every camp has it in Florida. And I walk in, and I tell him I'm getting out next week, and I want to thank him for having these meetings. He says, have a seat. And he said, do you know why I do this? And I said, because you have to? And he said, no, because I am one of you. And he said, you thought you were a bad alcoholic? I was better. And he said, we have all these programs, you know, inside, outside. This, AA, is the only one that saves lives. And he said, I'm telling you, walk out of here, you better help this program. So I get out and I move back to Pennsylvania and I'm reunited with my family and I'm active. I go to the International Convention in Atlanta. I'm with my sponsor and his wife, both in the program, their son who's not in the program. He was happy to be there. Weird kid, I used to tell him. And my sponsor's sponsors are there, and my sponsor's wife, Kelly, starts telling this family about, I used to call, I would make phone calls. I called home all the time. And I would call, my sponsor, I had agreement, I would call at 8:15. Never said what days. And I would call, and 95%+ of the time, one of them answered the phone. I never thought anything of it, right? It's me. You got it. You should do this for me. And they're talking, and she was telling them. I could hear it. Once again, I'm eavesdropping. And she's telling them that, yeah, when Michael was in prison, we would be out, and one of us would say, including their son, who might have been 12 at the time, oh, we got to get home. Michael might call. And I hear this. And I just stop. And I'm talking to somebody. I'm like, what? She said, yeah. And I just, like, I'm shook. Tears are coming out of me. And that's one of those motivating factors. Because I have to be guilted into things still. That they did that for me. And I can't do something for somebody else in this program. So I hear that and I come back. And I got to get into service. I'm taking the commitments in my home group. You know, I'm doing that. And one night at our business meeting, somebody said they asked for the general service report. And they're like, no report. I go, why isn't there a report? Well, we haven't had a general service rep in like 2 years. Somebody should do that. Okay, so why don't you do it? At this point in 2015, I'm 7 years sober. I do it. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I had no idea what I was doing. Once again, life-changing moment for me. Life-changing moment. Because I realize, you know, we talk about a pebble in the mosaic. There is so much out there. And I was having a problem watching the same Shark Tank episodes with my dad every night in there. And I started getting busier again. And my dad gave me a car when I got out of prison. And all he told me was, take people somewhere with this. Take them to those meetings you've got to go to. And I just fell into service. I am the last person that would ever volunteer or donate anything. I would get you to do it. I would get you to do it. I would do it. Could you take that for me? Could you take that for me? And I met people, and I meet people that, like, make me feel, once again, I guess you use the word guilty. Like, I got to do more. Because this program gave me my life back. And I used to hear these people, I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'd be like, there's no way. That's so, I'm so happy to be here. How happy can you? You know what? As my sister's best friend told me, the night, I was not going to go to this meeting to meet this sponsor the first time. And she called me. She said to me, Mike, I'll tell you this. I've been sober 4 years, and I haven't met anybody who says AA really messed up my life. And that's what I hear. That's what I hear. I get the chance to sponsor people now. I'm not really good at it. I shy away from it sometimes because I just way overstate my importance. Like, I could ruin somebody's life sponsoring them. However, I do it, and I love it. And I just love service. It's the place where I, like, found myself in AA. I was able to be the general service rep and learn a lot, be around a lot of people. And then we had our elections for the district. And we have a district of 85 home groups. That's a lot of home groups. Nobody stood for any positions. I said, I'll stand. And full disclosure, I probably stood because nobody was running against me. And I became the DCM. And I got a couple other people that joined the panel. And it's been the best experience. I have no idea what I'm going to do this time next year when I'm out of this role, that darn spirit of rotation. I'd like to stay forever because I'm comfortable with it, but it's not going to happen. And I went to the area assembly last week in Lancaster. First one I went to, I had no idea. I thought, like, this is stupid, but it was good. Whenever I say it's stupid, just assume that it's good. And this year we had a gentleman speak, Navajo Indian, Navajo Native American, and he led the translation of our book into the Navajo language, which is not a written language. Once again, he's telling his story, and I'm thinking, I don't want to get up and, you know, go do something for somebody, and this guy goes all over the world. Before I go, the quickest story. I'm about 5 years sober, and this gentleman in my home group asked me to take him to this roundup in South Jersey on a Friday night. He's sight deficient. So I take my dad's car, right? Big boy, I'm 53, I'm taking my dad's car. And we drive over and it snowed. I didn't want to go. It was cold out. And we get there and they want $40 to get into this place. I throw a fit. So I paid the $40. And he wanted to meet his original sponsor who was speaking there. Turns out his original sponsor was a trustee in AA. And this gentleman has 4 or 5 kids, his own business. And he was just telling us matter-of-factly in his hotel room that he travels like 26 weeks a year for AA. 26 weeks, weekends a year. He's brought meetings into third world nations. He like brought the first meeting into Iran or Iraq. I kind of lost which eye it was. And I'm standing there, sitting there thinking, I'm pissed off because I got to take somebody to a meeting. That was another reason why I went back and got into service. So it's life beyond my wildest dreams because I didn't have any dreams. I had none. I just played every day like it was not. My sponsor tells me, always you're right where your feet are supposed to be. Is it odd or is it God? And the one that he always ends with, which I become more comfortable with all the time, is, Michael, who has it better than we do? So that's why I'm here. That's why we're all here, to give it to somebody else away, so they don't have to say when somebody asks them who has it better than we do, I don't know. We do. It's tremendous. I am so happy I'm here, and I will bring people back to this meeting because I like intimate speaker meetings. I hope I haven't ruined it for everybody. And who has it better than we do? Thank you.